I am running out of introductory cleverness, so I will simply say, yay, it's Arthur Schwartz, the food mensch. Yay. Hi, Arthur.
Hi.
Hi. Are we okay?
We are fine.
Oh, good.
We're absolutely fine. We got a lot of mail, which I'm going to catch up on this morning or this afternoon or whenever you're listening. And no pot pie report this week. I haven't had a chance to get another pot pie. I considered making another pot pie, and then I thought better of it. But the one that I'm after, and maybe I'll go out today and get it, is the Trader Joe's, which I hear good things about. Well, we'll see.
So I thought your neighbor was... Okay.
Pardon me?
I, for some reason, thought your neighbor was going to bring you a Trader
Joe's. Well, she hasn't.
Okay. I know. All right.
Ellen does go to Trader Joe's. I don't really go to Trader Joe's. But in order to get this pot pie, I'd have to drive over, I suppose have Bob sit in the car at an illegal parking space while I run into Trader Joe's and hope the line isn't too long and get a pot pie. So, or three, whatever. But anyway, maybe I'll talk to Ellen later, and maybe she's going to go today. Anyway, point is, no pot pie report this week. But I have another report. I have a magnetic attraction to weirdo recipes. I see a weirdo recipe, I got to make it. Is this really going to work? I can't believe it. And there was one that was, I'm assuming I first learned about it from the New York Times. It was either featured or I'm a subscriber to the New York Times cooking website or whatever you call that, app. And it may have been there. In any case, I was not the only one in my family to be attracted to this recipe for butter swim biscuits. My nephew and my niece both saw this recipe and said, oh, we have to make this. But I did make it. I don't recommend it, but I'm going to tell you the saga of this. First of all, one of the reasons I made it, besides that it was a weirdo recipe that I just had to try, is that it called for 1 3/4 of a cup of buttermilk. I happen to have a pint of buttermilk sitting in my refrigerator in case of emergencies, and it's now been there for months. So I think I bought it in March. Buttermilk is already sour, so it doesn't go sour. I was a little bit wary of it, but I shook it up, and it was perfect. So I thought it was meant to be. These biscuits were meant to be. The biscuits swim in butter. This is the weird part. Buttermilk is the only liquid in the recipe, and there's no fat in the recipe, except I did have whole milk buttermilk, so that was a little fat. But you melt an entire stick of butter in an 8-inch square pan in the oven, 450 degrees, and melted butter. You can't pour this batter. You spatula this batter into the 8-inch square baking pan, and you squish it down to make it sort of smooth on top, and you will see. The butter rises to the top, totally covers the dough or the batter, whatever you want to call it. And you stick this in a 450-degree oven for 25 minutes or so. I did the or so, turning the pan once halfway through. When I opened the oven and I turned this halfway around, it was literally swimming in butter. I mean, the butter had bubbled up. It was the batter was covered in butter. By the time I took it out, 12 minutes later, the butter had mostly been absorbed by the dough, and what little was left at the bottom of the pan quickly got absorbed as the biscuits, so-called. They did not have the texture of a biscuit to me. The so-called biscuits absorbed the rest. Gotta say, the crispy edges and certain parts of the very bottom were incredibly buttery and delicious. And of a flavor, you may laugh at this, related to my grandmother's noodle pudding, because my grandmother's noodle pudding also has an inordinate amount of butter, and the butter also, it sort of collects in the corners and on the sides of the pudding and creates this nice, really delicious, buttery, crispy noodle thing. So in this case, it's not noodles, it's dough. So the dough is odd in one respect. It calls only for buttermilk as the only liquid. And normally, when you bake things with buttermilk, you add baking soda, which is what do you call the opposite of acid? Base. And the base and the acid act together and give a little oomph, a little leavening to the dough. In this case, it's just baking powder. And so I was wondering about that. And the fact is, even though the edges were deliciously crispy and buttery, the middle was horrible. And we had some friends from England come over for tea yesterday afternoon. It was a last minute thing. So I did feel bad that I had nothing in the house to serve with the tea except these biscuits, which by then had cooled down. But my English lady friend, she agreed with me. I would never make these again, even though she did also eat off the crispy edges. So you bake these already cut into 9 pieces. And I knew something was up when the recipe tells you to cut the dough before it's baked even into these 9 pieces, which of course allows all this melted butter to seep in between the pieces. But the instruction, I followed these instructions to the letter, really, to the letter. I did flour the way I always do it, which is spoon it into a cup and then level the cup so it wasn't compacted. So I know I didn't have too much flour. And I did add, I have to say, a couple of extra drops, literally, of buttermilk. So maybe I had 1 3/4 cup plus a tablespoon or so. There was some left over in the jar, so I know I didn't use the full 2 cups. In any case, these were just way too dense. So if this is a kind of recipe that intrigues you, don't be so intrigued. I don't know what to say.
I'm just going to add that there has been, way back in the day, I had friends who wrote cookbooks, and they always had to test the recipes, and recipe testing was, would take a while. You got to do it. But it seems that has fallen desperately out.
I must say, I'm going to defend the New York Times and say this is a well-tested recipe. And by the way, I think this was republished, so it was something that was popular. In any case, I'm a good mixer of batters and blah, 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 and mine did not come out as the recipe said it would, tender and light, anything but tender and light. I'll go back. I've made many a weirdo recipe in my life, but
yeah, some weirdo recipes are good. Some are really horrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway.
Quoting Kenny Klein.
So horrible. just be fair warned.
Okay.
Somebody who tests recipes for a living, meaning me, couldn't make this work the way it was described, although they looked good. So back to the mail. I've been getting very nice mail, and I try to answer them personally, but I'm not getting to every single one. Sorry, folks. But I did get a few this week that intrigued me, and I want to share. One of them is a question about vinegar. Now, vinegar is, I have to say, one of my areas of expertise. And I'm very particular about vinegar that I use in salads, which is what I say is the reason people always comment on my salads, that they're so delicious. It's only because I use great oil and great vinegar. And I'm actually out of my great vinegar and have not been able to restock my great vinegar, which is vinegar made from Barolo grapes, or any one of these northern Italian grapes make great vinegar. This week I bought vinegar made from Sangiovese grapes, which are the sort of the Cabernet of the south of Italy. I mean, it's the noble grape of the south. And it's very, very good. Hard to find. But one of the reasons I bought this vinegar, besides that I like flavorful red wine vinegar, is that it's 7.1 or 2% acidity. That's high. Most vinegar is only 6% acidity. But my listener, who wrote to me about vinegar, questioned this vinegar that she has. She was given the gift. This is often what happens. We get a gift of some kind of fancy food thing, and we don't really know what to do with it. Most of the time, people ask me, what do I do with this? I say, eat it. I mean, you get a jar of jam. What do I do with it? Eat it. I mean, people don't give jars of jam much these days, I don't think. Actually, do they? Do we know? Anyway.
Quick, totally random question, because someone...
Yeah.
I don't love balsamic vinegar, and...
No, neither do I.
And I've got a pretty good nose for it. What is the difference? Just because I was sitting there thinking, oh, God. I was sitting there thinking how to be diplomatic, but making sure that it didn't contaminate.
Well, I'm not a balsamic vinegar guy. I keep it in the house, and from time to time, I will use it in one of... use in particular that I is when I make caponata. By the way, just an aside here, I bought years and years ago, I used to buy Progresso brand caponata in a can. I haven't
right.
seen it in years, but I did see Cento brand the other day, so I bought that and I threw it away. It was horrible, which just made me think I have to make a batch of caponata, which lasts in the refrigerator for weeks, so it's okay. Anyway, I do. It's a sweet and sour dish, and so I do use balsamic vinegar. I wouldn't go out and buy a bottle of balsamic vinegar to do it, but I happen to have some, and it would be good to use it up, actually, pre-up the bottle. I have it in a very pretty bottle. Anyway, the vinegar that I was asked about is called vinegar of Turiga Nacional. Turiga Nacional is a very serious red grape from Portugal. Used to be only used in the blend to make port wine, but I don't know when, sometime in the late 20th century, somebody decided to pull it out of the blend and try it on its own, and it ends up to be a really sturdy, big red wine, and it's called Turiga Nacional. Anyway, our listener, Valerie, was given a bottle of it along with some other vinegar, and she doesn't know what to do with it. The person who gave it to her, I think very mistakenly, said, this is not for salad. I think that's exactly what it's for, or vegetables. Sometime you want a really bold-tasting red wine vinegar, and I often do. I mean, my everyday salads do. And I use actually more vinegar than the classic combination, which used to be, when I say classic, it's the one you'll read in books, three parts of oil to one part of vinegar. I'm more 50-50. For my big bowl of salad, I have the same salad spoons, by the way, for 50 years. Dansk. Do we remember Dansk? I'm not sure any Dansk pots, pans, other things are around anymore, but it was a very popular Danish... Pardon me? For the 1960s, it was high design. In any case, two spoons of oil, and I use two spoons of vinegar. I toss on the oil first, salt. I sometimes dissolve the salt a little bit in the two spoons of vinegar that I'm going to put in. Distributes more evenly. Pepper, nice amount of ground pepper. That's my basic salad, oil, vinegar, salt, pepper. And people rave, and they say, oh, what are you putting here? I said, nothing. Good vinegar, good oil. So my advice to Valerie is, unopen that vinegar. Your friend who said it was too strong, look on the label. It probably, if it is a strong vinegar, it'll say 7% or more. but most vinegar is 6% in any case. I like the stronger acid vinegar only because you can use less of it, meaning less liquid in the salad. I can use a scant two salad spoons instead of two full salad spoons. Right now, I'm using the Sangiovese vinegar, and if you only if your supermarket doesn't have any kind of fancy vinegar, don't worry. One of the ones that I've been buying that I'm very happy with is just flew out of my brain, but it'll come back in the supermarket. So anyway, I'll get back to vinegar in a minute, because I also got a very cute note about Tam Tams or Tom Toms, which are these kosher crackers that I grew up eating. I was thinking about it when I was thinking about what to talk about today, and I realized that one of the big flavors of my boyhood was chopped liver on a Tom Tom or Tam Tam cracker. But anyway, it ends up Tam Tams or Tom Toms, which are kosher, have two versions. There's a kosher for Passover version, and there's a normal version. I'm not sure what the difference is. They have the same ingredients, except that the Passover one is probably made from special flour, and it may be supervised better. The other ones don't have to be supervised because, you know, when I say supervised, matzah for Passover, the wheat, the grain, the flour cannot be in contact with moisture, with water, actually water, for more than 18 minutes. And no other ingredients are allowed for Passover matzah. However, there is such a thing as egg matzah, even for Passover. But if you add the egg to the normal flour, water, matzah, you can't use water. Don't ask. I mean, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a scholar of this. I just know that you have to use apple juice instead of water when you add the egg to the matzah. So I think the difference between the Passover ones and the not Passover ones is minimal, if existing at all. In any case, I called them Tam Tams or Tom Toms, as other people say. And just, you know, that was the main way of eating chopped liver when I was a kid. Because chopped liver was, I mean, we ate it at the table sometimes with vegetables and some kind of good bread. But mostly it was served, you know, at parties, spread. It was, you know, the old joke was it was always formed into these incredible figures. Like, you know, you could have a, I don't know, what could you have made out of chopped liver? There were a lot of things made out of chopped liver. And then you spread it on a cracker, and the cracker was invariably a tam-tam or tam-tam.
All right, now the inevitable question, because we're talking about chopped liver, and it's making me think of everything. So how do you make your chopped liver?
Well, I don't.
Okay.
I don't make real chopped liver anymore. Not in a long time, mainly because I don't have a good audience for it. What I do make is vegetarian chopped liver. And I have to say, it's one of my favorite recipes from my cookbook, Jewish Home Cooking. I make it frequently. And it's based on string beans. There's no liver in it. There's no animal. It's vegan, if you think about it. So it's vegan. I overcook fresh, nice string beans, meaning I put them into salted boiling water for at least 8 minutes, sometimes 10, depends on the string beans. Sometimes these the fat ones take more time, but you definitely want them well cooked. So after 10 minutes, you drain them, let them cool down, and the base of this is the string beans, but also, and what makes it taste like chopped liver and not vegetables, is a lot of fried onions. So chop up or slice up a lot of onions. I would say for a couple of pounds, I make this in large quantity because besides I have a good audience for it, it lasts for several, if not number of days, and we can eat it for a few days. But if you want to make just a pound of string beans, I would say 1 pound of string beans. a half a cup of walnuts you're going to need, and at least 2 cups, if not 3 cups, of sliced or chopped onions, cooked until they are really dark, in a few tablespoons of oil. I wouldn't use olive oil for this. I just use my plain, I use peanut oil or canola oil or vegetable oil, whatever oil. I mean, until those onions are really dark. Some of them are really caramelized. And you put in a blender, I don't mean a blender, a food processor, the nuts, the walnuts, the onions, the very well-cooked string beans. And for a pound of, I must say, for 2 pounds of string beans, I use 5 eggs, 5 hard-cooked eggs. So for 1 pound, 2 is probably enough. You want to put 3 in, put 3 in. You chop it all up, you grind it all up together until it's the consistency you like. I don't like it too pasty. I like a little, still a little texture there. And that's it. Salt, pepper. Takes a lot of salt, takes a lot of pepper. Taste it, adjust it. Once you've gotten it to the right consistency in the food processor, scrape it into a bowl and do your re-seasoning in the bowl, because you don't want to overwork the whole deal there into a paste. I'm getting hungry talking about it, because I do like vegetarian chopped liver
a lot.
You
started it.
Pardon me?
You started it.
I know. Well, I mean, really, it is something I make frequently because we like it so much. And we can have that as a meal, by the way, with, you know, sliced up tomato, cucumber, some good bread. It's a meal. But also, now I have to have it on Tom Tom crackers or Tam Tam crackers, because I haven't done that in a long time. So I mentioned my book, Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, which is still in print. But I know this is going to, was a surprise to me, I'm selling the digital version of Southern Home Cooking, of the Southern Italian Table, it's called. Now, I got a royalty, or I've been getting like a steady one book a month royalty. So now I'm trying to see if I can get 2 books. You have to have a digital reader to get this book, but I have to say I'm proud of the digital version of Southern Italian Table. And in fact, the cover of the book, of the digital book, is the cover that I wanted for the hardcover book, but didn't get because my publisher didn't like it as much as I did. But it's the stovetop and cover pot cover rack of my dear deceased friend Delia, Zia Delia, Aunt Delia. She was Cecilia's aunt, the youngest sister of Cecilia's mother, and she lived into her mid-90s, cooking every day. Maybe at the very end she didn't cook, but when you went to her house, she was very proud of this. She took you into her room that she used as a larder, I would call it, with shelf after shelf of preserved vegetables, jarred tomatoes. On the floor would be baskets of vegetables getting ready to be done with. And she had no children, but she had a lot of nieces and nephews, all who loved to come by and visit and go home with food. So she supplied them well. Anyway, that's Zia Delia's kitchen, which I loved, on the cover of Southern Italian Table. And as I mentioned, the Jewish book is still in print. And you know what else is still in print? My New York City book, Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food. Now, of course, it does look more like a history than it did when it was published. But because it was as a history of New York food, it ends in the mid-'80s. And so here we are 40 years later, and the city has changed significantly since then, meaning we have a lot more ethnicities than we did back then that are influencing the food of New York at large and the country at large. That's what that book was supposed to be about, recording the dishes and the history of the dishes that come from New York, maybe still are made in New York, but have influenced the American table in general. So that book is still in print also. Naples at Table, there is a digital version of Naples at Table. I'm afraid to look at it because that had some history that I don't want to think about anymore. And that's it. Oh, you know what? My bestseller, of course, and you're a fan of this book, Jill,
yes,
is
Soup Suppers.
And I still make the – in fact, there's a recipe in Soup Suppers that I am going to make this week. But besides that, it's been on my mind. It calls for a lot of fresh mint. And right now, the one thing that came back or keeps coming back from my old herb garden on the street here is the mint. And I have enough mint coming up now to make rashta, which is one of the many recipes for lentils and pasta that I love. And this one, rashta, is made with an egg noodle and lots of garlic and mint. So that's it. No biscuits this week.
Like I said, you're making me hungry. I'm just going to throw... I like cookbooks. A dear friend of mine, I remember when it started being a thing to bring your tablet into the kitchen and get it grease spattered. But I don't know. I still like cookbooks. I'm just throwing it out there.
You know, I love my cookbooks, but nobody... And I'm trying to... this is a plug for me. I am trying to... distribute is a nice word, to give away a lot of my cookbooks, but nobody wants them.
I can't believe that. I
don't even want to start, but there are cookbook dealers
list,
in New York,
ask
and one of them, who I know, doesn't even answer my phone calls anymore. I don't know who wants cookbooks anymore. If you want cookbooks, if you still love cookbooks, write to me at mmiles@Robin Hood Radio. In fact, if you have anything on your mind you want me to know, you can write to me at mmiles@Robin Hood Radio. Okay, Jill?
Okay, at robinhoodradio.com.
Robinhoodradio.com.
No, somebody once said, I don't know why you're not .org. Never mind. Robinhoodradio.com. And I think that we are going to find someone who wants those cookbooks, because otherwise...
Well, I have literally thousands of cookbooks. And I actually can't resist books in general, but we have a rule now that something comes in, something's got to go out.
I understand.
Yeah.
That rule usually starts at about, I don't know.
My niece and my nephew, both of whom cook every day.
Right.
Brian is the main cook in his house with a wife and two kids, and Rachel is the main cook in her house with a husband and two kids, and they use the internet. And I have given them many a book. I mean, on occasion they'll say, oh, I made something from your book here or there, you know? But mainly it's because they have some childhood memory of it, maybe when I was testing it or whatever. In any case, young people use the internet. And you can't find everything on the internet, believe me. And I don't think reading recipes on the internet is as satisfying as sitting down with a book. My little book speech. On the other hand, I have digital books to sell.
I understand. So anyway, I just weighed in on the digital. To each his own, A. And B, there is nothing better than curling up with a cookbook and reading the recipe and seeing what you would do better or what you wouldn't.
Or just be inspired or whatever.
Or be inspired.
I must say, I acquired, I won't tell you how, but the unabridged version of Il Talismano del Felicità, which is the Bible of Italian Cooking by Ada Boni, A-D-A-B-O-N-I, Boni. Ada Boni's book is like the joy of cooking in Italy.
Right.
And I only have an abridged version, and I have an English edition, and I just acquired this book, which I know very, very well, but still, I must have spent 2 hours yesterday reading this book. But you know what? It's also the practice Italian. It's in Italian, so I have to read in Italian, and I learned from one of my teachers that a good thing to do is to read out loud in Italian.
Okay, guys.
That was my 2-hour
time to wrap.
Today.
All right.
Okay, kids. everybody have a great week. If you hear of any great pot pies, write to me, mmiles@robinhoodradio.com. And I'm off to Trader Joe's sometime soon.
Just know how much we appreciate you, and we thank you, and we will talk to you next week. This has been Arthur Schwartz, the Food Mensch on Robin Hood Radio.